This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
Karlstadt will actually reappear in the Luther narrative in that after the debacle of the Peasants' War, Karlstadt's on the run. And late one night he turns up at Luther's house. And although they have become sort of deadly enemies, Luther and his wife give him shelter for a little while. And I think it's one of those sort of, it's not quite the British and the Germans playing football in no man's land on Christmas Day 1914. But it must have been odd that when these two men who were so implacable, had been such good close friends and then become such implacable enemies, you know, shared table fellowship with each other for a little while. Karlstadt is on the run. I want to talk now about Luther's thinking as it develops up to 1525. One of the crucial areas of Luther's thinking is on secular authority. In 1523, he writes a treatise on secular authority, to what extent it should be obeyed. And it's here that he really develops what Zwei Reiche is the German. It's translated as two kingdoms. Now, just for the record, I appreciate much of what's being done in terms of the modern two kingdom stuff, but I have significant hesitations, partly on the historiography side. I think I said yesterday that I have difficulty. To me, as a historian, it's just difficult to jump from any political discussion in the 16th century to the 21st century because the frames of reference are so utterly different. Secondly, I am very concerned about the more radical statements of two-kingdom theology where it becomes, you know, Christianity makes no difference to your behavior in the earthly kingdom. That seems to me to fly in the face of simple biblical teaching, that Christianity is to make a difference in how you live your life. If you were to come to my church, I'm not going to tell you from the pulpit who you should vote for whom you should vote. I'm not going to tell you whether you should smoke. I'm not going to tell you whether you should drink alcohol. But I trust that what you hear from the pulpit will shape how you think about all those issues in your life. I'm just not going to micromanage your life for you. I'm going to confront you with the word and trust that the Lord's Spirit will give you wisdom for dealing with these different life issues as they pop up. I would, of course, preach a pro-life sermon when the text demanded it. The text was teaching about the sanctity of life. I would preach a pro-life sermon. So I'm aware, as it's probably the first year I've ever given this lecture, and I realize this stuff's getting sort of controversial out there. I'm approaching Luther as a historian at this point, but you know, my sympathies broadly lie with much of what Luther is saying. I did have somebody once suggesting to me by email that I found out who voted Democrat in my congregation and excommunicated them all. We're just not going to do that. I'm not going to ask people how they vote. It's none of my business, to be frank. Anyway, Luther here articulates in this work his notion that that human beings belong to two kingdoms. There is the kingdom of the church, or the kingdom of the word, and the kingdom of the world. And they operate on different bases. The kingdom of the church. The church rules by word and sacrament. The kingdom of the world rules by the sword. And Luther regards the establishment of the civil magistrate and the establishment of the civil order as something set in place by God himself. The sword, Luther sees as a good thing. We submit to the civil magistrate as one who is placed there by God. One of the pastoral problems Luther faces in the pastoral ministry, he gets questions from his parishioners. Can I be a soldier? He actually writes a treatise that soldiers too can be saved, in which he argues that it is perfectly legitimate to bear the sword and to kill on behalf of the civil magistrate. He raises the question of, can a man be a hangman? Yes. It is appropriate for a Christian to be a hangman, because if somebody has committed a crime that merits the penalty of death, somebody's got to be there to pull the lever or drop the axe. If you visit medieval villages, you often find that there's a little house out in the middle of a field somewhere, and that's often where the hangman lived. And you get the idea that, yeah, everybody wanted him to do his job, but nobody wanted, he was not good for property values, I suspect. You wanted him living in the middle of nowhere. So in Luther's mind, there is a separation of church and state in terms of their spheres of authority and that which they use to govern those spheres. By the way, that would be another of my hesitations with modern two kingdoms theology, is that I'm not convinced that natural law is the answer, because it seems to me that people suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and that kind of skews what you think is morally appropriate and not morally appropriate. But Luther sees this separation, but he doesn't see it in Anabaptist terms. At the back of his mind, there are Anabaptist groups beginning to emerge in the early 1520s who really do separate the kingdom of the world from the kingdom of the church, such that if you join the church, you leave the world. This is the origin, of course, for example, of people like the Quakers. I don't know if it's the same in this country, but back home in Britain, I think Quakers are given a dispensation, or were at one time, that they didn't have to take an oath when they appeared in court. The court had no jurisdiction to demand that of them, as far as they were concerned. So back of Luther's mind, I think he's concerned to separate the spheres of church and state, but not to separate them materially. Everybody in Saxony is responsible to the sword and to the word. Raises an acute question in Luther reception, and that is the question of resistance. And it's become, of course, a far more acute question in the last 100 years than it was prior to that. On what basis can a Christian, or should a Christian, resist the civil magistrate? The obvious reason for this becoming an acute question was the complicity of certain churchmen in the Third Reich, particularly in the Holocaust. And the question as to whether Lutheran church tradition actually gave them an excuse not to protect the innocent. Certainly, Luther in 1523 seems to have a pretty black and white view. You don't resist the authorities. You might say, well, but what happens if the authority is Hitler? Well, Luther would say this, well, you know, Hitler's put there by God. Hitler is God's representative, foul and terrible as that may seem. Read your Old Testament. The Lord uses all kinds of pagan kings as agents of judgment on the people of Israel. If the Lord sends a corrupt ruler, he sends judgment against the people. Should you resist the Persians as they come flooding in? Should you look to Egypt for an alliance or escape route? No, the Lord says no. Same today. That, of course, if you then connect straight to the Third Reich, that's, well, what do you do about Luther? You mind your own business. You walk by on the other side of the street, you mind your own business. I'm not so convinced that even that is the case. You know, I actually think Luther changes his mind on resistance later. A lot of the problem with Luther reception is what's received of Luther is the early Luther, not the later Luther. That's the case for sanctification. I think it's the case for political theory. But even in 1523, I think there are grounds for resistance in Luther. Let's jump forward to the present day and think of a situation that one of you, if you're a medic, could be placed in at some point. You're a doctor and you're instructed to perform an abortion. What do you do? Well, it's a bit of a dilemma, isn't it, if you're a non-resistance kind of person, because your employee is above you and they have the right to demand this of you. Your employer has the right to demand it of you. On the other hand, you have strong opinions about abortion. What do you do? Well, I think Luther's logic of 1523 would be this. You refuse to do it because you answer to God, not to man on that issue. And then your employer says to you, okay, you're fired. You can't say no. Breach of contract, you're fired. I think Luther would say, you accept that, yeah, I breached my contract. My employer has every right to fire me. I accept my firing, and I go on my way and find another job somewhere. I don't think that Luther in 1523 demands that you comply actively with corrupt authorities, any more than Daniel complied actively with corrupt authorities. Daniel doesn't really resist the authorities so much as conform to the law of God. Last thing Luther would say, you shouldn't sue. I mean, for Luther, that would be, at that point, an example of defiance. Luther does change his mind on this, though. 1530, Melanchthon has drawn up the Augsburg Confession. The empire meets once again at Augsburg. There are high hopes that the emperor will sign on, will subscribe the Augsburg Confession. Imagine how history would have been different if the emperor had subscribed the Augsburg Confession and become a confessional Lutheran. The emperor does not do it. Devastating blow to Luther. Luther becomes a much more introspective and dark figure after 1530. I like introspective dark figures, so he kind of starts to appeal to me at that point. You know, you move into the seventh seal sort of territory in Luther. But he also changes his opinion on resistance. And it's interesting enough, it's a kind of anticipation of John Calvin. Calvin is often seen as the man who opens the way to later resistance theory. Calvin, you see, develops this idea that the lower magistrate may resist in certain circumstances the higher magistrate. It's not for the likes of you and me, you know, the scum of the earth, to resist the magistrate. But magistrates can resist magistrates. Well, Luther sort of anticipates that argument in 1530 by playing on the legalities of the empire and arguing, well, you know, the emperor, his authority actually flows from the electors because it is the electors who appoint him. And therefore, the electors have the right to resist the emperor. Bingo. Great result, because it means that the Lutheran electors don't have to reimpose Catholicism in their territory. Great example of how pragmatic necessity, I think, influences the logic of an argument. And you get the idea that, yes, the elector of Saxony, John by that point, can continue to resist the emperor because the emperor actually derives his power, in a sense, from the elector. If you've ever read, I've dipped into it, but I've not read much of Eric Metaxas's biography of Bonhoeffer, but I do remember in Bethge's biography, there's a great section, and Bethge was a personal friend of Bonhoeffer, there's a great section in there where Bonhoeffer, as a Lutheran pastor, wrestles with the extent to which he, as a Lutheran pastor, can resist the Nazi regime. And from memory, I think Bonhoeffer convinces himself that Hitler is an antichrist figure and therefore the normal rules don't apply. So if Bonhoeffer had known his Luther history a little better, he might have been able to, you know, to get around that better. But ultimately, man's the antichrist, so he doesn't apply. Luther himself gives a little nod in that sort of direction, in that he will allow, for example, it's in On Secular Authority, he does allow for a category of person to whom the normal rules don't apply. Samson. I preached a series on Judges a couple of years ago, and you know, the Judges are all, you know, Hebrews 11 is such a problem for the book of Judges, because the book of Judges, they're all such criminals, you know, and then he's told in Hebrews they're paragons of virtue and examples of the faith. Samson's a bad lad. There's all kinds of bad stuff in the Samson story. For Luther, and I'm going to choose my words carefully here to give you a hint of where I'm going. For Luther, Samson is a man beyond good and evil. He is a man to whom the normal rules don't apply because he has a special calling from God and therefore he can just go for it. Why did I use the term beyond good and evil?
Nietzsche.
Sorry?
Nietzsche.
Where does Nietzsche connect to Luther?
His
pyramid. Yes. And they both had facial hair at one point. His father was a Lutheran pastor. Nietzsche grew up in a pious Lutheran home. And I have often wondered, what does Dad preach? Did Nietzsche get his idea for the Übermensch from Luther? Wouldn't that be? I mean, unfortunately, I doubt that Nietzsche's going to be in heaven for me to ask him that one. You know, maybe Nietzsche's dad will be there. But I've often wondered, when I read some bits of Luther, I think, wow, some of his ethical stuff, kind of, I'm not saying he's a Nietzschean, but this kind of Samson as a wild man who just transcends ethical codes and sort of makes it up as he goes along, that sounds like the new man. When Luther, when Nietzsche, in is it Thus Spoke Zarathustra, is talking about the new man. Sounds like the new men to me. I just throw that out there as a pure bit of speculation, but I love to try to make these connections. For Luther, then, he culminates his treatise in describing what a good ruler looks like. A good ruler, he says, will serve his subjects, should not be a tyrant. A good ruler will know his counselors. And he says, he's quite astute, he says, a good ruler will despise none of his counselors to the point that will make them his enemy. But he will not trust any one of them so much that they'll have too much influence. Luther's a bit of kind of Christian Machiavelli, really, as he writes this treatise. A good ruler will always deal justly with evildoers. And a good ruler will subject himself to God and pray for wisdom to rule well, as did Solomon. We come now to 1525. 1525 is an important year, a watershed year in Luther's life. It's the year of the great clash with Erasmus and the breach with humanism. And Luther passionately hated Erasmus after 1525. When news of Erasmus' death arrives in Wittenberg, Luther's only comment is, "What a pity he didn't die as soon as he'd produced the Greek New Testament." Because he did so much damage after that. There was none of this. You know, if you notice in politics, when your deadliest enemy dies, everybody queues up to say how wonderful they were. Yeah, Luther, no, he wasn't in for that kind of thing. If you're his enemy and you died, he danced on your grave. And I have to say, I kind of respect a man who has the backbone to do that, frankly. It was also the year of his marriage that we'll come to shortly, which is crucially important for his later ministry. And it was also the year of the Peasants' War. The Peasants' War will tarnish Luther's reputation. The two things of which Luther is most notorious for are his literary attacks on the peasants, and his literary attacks on the Jews. The Peasants' War is really—it's a slight misnomer. It wasn't a single war. It was the culmination of a series of peasant rebellions. It was going to happen sooner or later. Economic changes in Europe had led to depopulation of rural areas, which had created declining revenues for landlords and increased pressure on the peasantry. From the early 15th century, peasant unrest had started to pop up in Europe. Anti-clericalism was becoming a real force. Anti-clericalism was on the rise in the late Middle Ages. As economic wealth declined in rural areas, church taxes became increasingly burdensome, and you had a powerful recipe for resentment of the church, as it is seen as placing economic burdens on the countryside. And in the cities, of course, in cities, by and large, cities prize youth and productivity. Youth productivity and inventiveness. Always have done, always will. The church is increasingly seen as parasitic in those kind of contexts. What does the church do? It's an anachronism. It doesn't contribute to things. Anticlericalism was also developing a powerful language that was correlated with the powerful language of the Lutheran Reform, essentially the language of freedom. Powerful language that spoke to the peasants. We had groups like the Bundschuh, rising in Alsace in the 1490s, active until 1524 when they were finally crushed in the Black Forest Rebellion. A group that demanded a return to godly law in order to see justice done. And therefore a group that naturally saw an affinity with the kind of stuff that was coming from Luther and from Zwingli. And then there was the Wittenberg program that connected directly with anti-clericalism. Not only in the Luther campaign for the priesthood of all believers, which interestingly enough virtually vanishes from Luther and all other reformers after 1525. Calvin does not say a lot about the priesthood of all believers, because after 1525, that's bad language to use. That's the language that the peasant rebellion used to cause trouble. And you have Zwilling and Karlstadt. And those guys are interesting because they represent the emergence in the Wittenberg establishment of political radicalism allied to theological radicalism. Initially, 1517, 18, 19, you seem to have one vision of reform, but actually no. Karlstadt sees this eschatological hope much more in terms of social transformation. He's in the game of transforming society. And if necessary, that can be done by the violence of iconoclasm. His very dress, dressing in a peasant's uniform, he's no more a peasant than anybody else on the faculty at Wittenberg is. But dressing as a peasant sends a political message. So a series of rebellions break out in the early 1500s, and they reach their climax in 1525. The period of the Peasants' War has proved a ripe stamping ground for historians over the years, partly because Friedrich Engels, he basically funded Marx when he was living in England. A couple of years ago, I was in London, and I was with Pete Lilbach, and we're passing through North London on the tube, and I say, "Do you know where Karl Marx is buried?" And he says, "Moscow." And I say, "No, he's buried in Highgate, which is the next stop on the tube." And he said, "We've got to get off and see it. We've got to get off and see this." So we get off the tube and we walk. It's about 2 miles. I stand at Karl Marx's grave with Pete Lilbach. There's this massive bust of Marx in Highgate Cemetery. And I've got a photo in my office of myself and Pete standing under this massive bust. Just to give you, it's an interesting, when Marx was buried, Engels gave the funeral address standing at the graveside, and there was hardly anybody there. It was pouring with rain. And anybody walking through Highgate Cemetery that day would have wondered what that loony's talking about over there. And Engels says, as he's speaking at Marx's grave, he says, "Within 50 years, everyone will have heard of this man's name." I don't think you'd have walked past him that day and you'd have thought he was an absolute loony. Within 50 years, this man being buried in a peasant's grave, his thinking had torn the world apart. So just remember, next time you pass a loony street preaching in Philadelphia, who knows? But Hitler and Stalin were both tramps in the same square in Vienna early in the 20th century. You could walk through the square in Vienna and passed Hitler and Stalin as tramp-like figures in this square. Just imagine, two men who basically determined the shape of European history in the 20th century as down and outs in Vienna. It's remarkable to think of, isn't it? Anyway, Engels, who made this speech, wrote a history of the Peasants' War, because Engels saw the Peasants' War as crucial to the truth of the Marxist theory of history. For Engels, it represented a revolution, a class war. Much work has been done since then to show that actually the class divisions are much less clear-cut in the Peasants' War than Engels wished to make them out to be. But the Peasants' War is a significant bone of historical interpretative contention because of the way it feeds into political theory. Given you on your handout, Thomas Munzer. Central to the Peasants' War is the man called Thomas Munzer. Saw Luther at Leipzig, was bowled over by Luther's theology. In 1519, he connects with Karlstadt and became very interested in the works of medieval mystics, especially Tauler. Mysticism, we often tend to think of mysticism in sort of Buddhist kind of terms. Mysticism is sitting around having nice kind of experiences of God, isn't it? Mysticism can also mean being led by the Spirit to direct action. That's what it meant for Munzer. Munzer's a mystic. He's led by the Spirit to violent action. He travels around Europe as a sort of pastor. Oh, we do have the name of one of the Zwickau prophets here. Nicholas Storck, S-T-O-R-C-H, connects with the Zwickau prophets, goes to Prague, returns to Saxony, and preaches before Duke John of Saxony on Daniel 2, demanding that it is time that the princes of the empire adopt a revolutionary standpoint, sweep away the old idolatrous religion, and bring about a proper social revolution here and now. This doesn't go down well. Munzer has to flee. And Luther, when he gets wind of this sermon, enters the fray and writes his work, Letter to the Princes of Saxony Concerning the Rebellious Spirit, to which Munzer replies with a wonderfully entitled, A Highly Provoked Vindication and Refutation of the Unspiritual, Soft Living Flesh in Wittenberg, whose robbery and distortion of Scripture has so grievously polluted our wretched Christian church. That's quite a title. When the Peasants' Rising occurs, late 1524, early 1525, Munzer thinks this is the eschatological sign he's been waiting for, and he throws in his lot with the Peasants, expecting this to be the end. 12th of May, 1525, he joins a force of 7,000 Peasants at Frankenhausen, and they are obliterated by a joint Protestant-Catholic army from the Empire. And Munzer flees from the barn, is discovered in the barn, and is taken out and is tortured to death with red-hot pokers. Most unpleasant way to go, I'm sure. Luther scores two massive own goals during the Peasants' War. First own goal, he writes sympathetically about the peasants. He can see their suffering. He can see that there are economic austerities they're having to put up with. But when the violence enters the scene, Luther has to distance himself rapidly from that violence, lest the Reformation be pulled down with it. And so he writes his work Against the Robbing, Murdering Hordes of Peasants, in which he makes the statement that these are strange times, he says, when a prince can get more easily to heaven by slaying a peasant than by believing in Jesus Christ. It's a pretty extreme statement. And he says, you know, if you're riding along and you see a peasant, an apparently innocent peasant, walking along on the side of the roads, jump off your horse and slay him. It's really a rallying call to genocide, if I could put it that way, in the way that his writings on the Jews will be. What could we say about Luther's rhetoric? Well, a couple of things. One, can't excuse it. It's terrible. Two, I think it's the case with a man like Luther that the character traits that make him remarkably effective at doing the good things he does make him a remarkable liability in the wrong situation. If Luther wasn't a man who ultimately was absolutely convinced of his own rightness and therefore was able to deal with his opponents in extreme and dismissive ways, he would not have survived. He'd have been swept away. But because he's that kind of person, when he gets on the wrong side of an argument, it all ends horribly. The rhetoric that we know and love when he's aiming it at the Pope, it's kind of fun when it's the Pope being, you know, slaughtered by a prince, is not quite so tasteful when it's a peasant or a Jew. So I would say it's of a piece with Luther's personality. And by and large, I think there's a truth there for most of us, that our strengths are often our weaknesses. Your ability to get something done in a good situation can sometimes be your inability to listen to advice in a situation that calls for more nuance. So that is that. And it really leaves Luther with a very bad reputation in terms of the reception of Luther's writings later on. The second own goal that he scores and is his marriage to Catherine von Bora. Did the picture come out on the handout I sent you? Katie always, but she had her portrait painted numerous times by Lucas Cranach, and she was always critical of them because she actually said she was far more beautiful than he ever painted her. That's possibly untrue, because by and large, if you are a portrait artist, you do want to paint people more beautiful than they really are, because that's flattering. But all the same, I mean, she looks quite... She's not unattractive, I think, when you look at her. She's a pleasant-looking lady. There's a sort of nice backstory to the Luther romance, or lack of romance, really. As the Reformation spreads across Saxony, it is creating something of a demographic problem. Monasteries and nunneries are closing down, throwing onto the open market lots of single men and single women. The logical way to solve the problem is to marry the nuns off with the monks. You know, it's how female monasticism began, if you remember, in the early church, that you got these men going off to monasteries, which left all these women out there with nobody to provide for them. So you have female monasticism and male monasticism running parallel in the ancient church. When it starts to fall apart in the 16th century, it's natural, so to speak, they come back together again, I suppose. Catherine von Bora was from a fairly well-to-do Saxon family, and she was a nun at the nunnery in Nimshan. And she had the reputation there of being quite headstrong. And as the Reformation spreads, a group of them decide to escape to Wittenberg. So Catherine and a group of her pals clamber into fish barrels and are taken to Wittenberg in fish barrels. The 16th century must have smelt remarkably bad, I think, a lot of the time. It's one of the least attractive ideas of living in the 16th century is smell would have been terrible. And when you hear facts like that they'd have to, on days when they drew the water out of the river in Wittenberg to brew the beer, they had to tell people not to be relieving themselves up water of where they were drawing the water. It just gets worse the more you know about the 16th century. If you ask me which period of history would you like to live in, I'd say, around about now. I've not been, we have analgesics, anesthetics, flush toilets. I've never been conscripted to fight in a world war. And my granddad used to say, I'm glad I'm old. I wouldn't like to be young today. And I'd say, granddad, when you were young, there was a war. 6 million people died in a Holocaust. You were having to run your kids down to the bomb shelter to avoid the bombs every night. I'd much rather be around today than the 1940s, 30s, 20s, or whenever. But certainly the 16th century. I'd rather have been around in ancient Rome, I think, because at least they had central heating and saunas than I would in the 16th century. One can only imagine that when they arrived in Wittenberg, bad stench there must have been in the place. These nuns would not have improved the ambience at any point as they climbed out of the fish barrels. Anyway, Luther's getting, he's quite old by this point. 1523, he's well into his middle age. At this point, he's what? He's 50? 40? He's 40, isn't he? Yeah, so he's younger than I am. But he's well into his middle age by those standards. I think guys like me are still pretty young today. But anyway, he's really old by 16th century standards at this point. And he's certainly a bachelor. I mean, if I don't want to sort of discourage you if you're a single guy in your 30s or 40s, but you start to pick up habits. Now, I got married at 23, and it was bad enough then for my wife to break the bad habits I'd picked up by the time I was 23. By the time you're 30, 40, you're developing ways of living that no woman is ever going to want to take on. Luther is a bachelor. I mean, he says, one of the things he says when they ask him, how's life changed since you were married? He says, well, he said, before I was married, the sheets would be stiff with sweat before I would have them laundered. So he was very much your archetypal man cave, disgusting bachelor type. Anyway, the nuns are all married off, but there's one left, Catherine von Bora, and they make various attempts to marry her off to various people. And eventually they try to marry her off to this elderly Lutheran pastor who's described, I think, by Martin Brecht as a skinflint, which tells you everything. And she adamantly, she says, I am not marrying this man. So at that point, it's decided she'll marry Martin Luther. There is a story that she comes to Wittenberg and says, you know, I'm not going to marry anybody unless it's Martin Luther. I don't think that's true. The marriage, they certainly grew to love each other, but it was not a marriage born out of love, as far as I can tell. A couple of other facts about her. I gave a Luther talk on Luther's marriage a few months ago at a church, and there was a front row where all these sort of 15-year-old girls, and when I was sort of talking about how, you know, well, they just decided she'd got to marry Luther, and that was it. Their eyes were like saucers. They thought, wow, so you mean the elders at our church would have decided who we were going to marry kind of thing. Anyway, Luther marries her. There has to be a witness at the consummation. Johannes Bugenhagen, Luther's friend, witnesses the consummation, describes it as a most distressing experience. I've often thought, you know, if it's distressing for Bugenhagen, this young lady was a nun 2 years ago. How distressing must it have been for her? But it's important. Luther's world is not our world. Luther's world is not our world. If there was not a witness there, somebody would write a pamphlet claiming that something weird had happened, that demons had appeared, or that Katie'd got cloven hooves or something like that. It was important somebody was there, because there is a sense in which, in the 16th century, there is no privacy for a public figure like Martin Luther. Even the most intimate and private of his actions, given the context, are kind of public. So Luther marries Katie. They have what appears to be, I think, a marriage where they truly grow to love each other. She bears him 6 children. One dies at 8 months. And one, a daughter to whom he was particularly close, dies at 13 years. There is a painting of Luther preaching, which has Katie and Luther's daughters in a row. And 2 of the daughters have their faces, it's almost like a niqab or something, but it isn't. 2 of them have scarves across their faces. And that was a convention for indicating that was a child who died. So that they were in the painting. They were part of the family, but the painter was indicating that they had died. They'd passed away. Some of Luther's most... I used to read them. I find them almost unbearable to read, actually. Luther's account of the death of his 13-year-old daughter is one of the most moving things that you will ever read. It is reprinted in the Timothy Lull collection. I think at the start, under sort of autobiographical fragments or something, you'll find there where Luther is counseling his daughter as she's dying, talking to her as she's dying, and then goes to arrange for the coffin to be made for her. It is a very, very moving and emotional piece of writing. He jokingly referred to Katie as his chain, play on the the Latin word catena, which means chain, is rather like the Latinized word of Catherine, Katharina. If you visit their house in Wittenberg, they have a stone doorway with two. Well, they would get as a wedding present, Elector John. Frederick the Wise died in 1525 and was succeeded by Elector John, John Frederick. Elector John gave Luther the monastery as a wedding present. The Augustinian cloister became his home. And the outside door has this wonderful stone frame with two seats on it that was a wedding gift from Katie to Luther one year, because she became convinced that they weren't talking to each other enough. He was always busy. So she had this door frame made so that each evening after the work business of the day, they could sit on either side of the door and talk to each other. And they also had one of the rooms upstairs modified to have a seat inserted either side of the window. So if it was raining, and this is, you know, Eastern Germany, rain is not unfamiliar in Eastern Germany. So if it was raining, they could sit upstairs on opposite sides of the window and talk as well. She outlives Luther by a few years, has to flee Wittenberg in 1547 when the emperor rolls into town, smashes the Schmalkaldic League, the Lutheran Military Defense League, rolls into Wittenberg, and Katie flees. Dies of the plague, I think, in 1552. Of all of her children, none of them particularly shone. The most tragic was certainly Martin Luther Jr. If you're the son of Martin Luther, the last thing you want to be called is Martin Luther, and the last thing you want to do is become a theologian, because you will never beat your dad. You will spend your whole life trying to be as good as your dad, and you will never achieve it. And Martin Luther Jr. dies in the 1560s, I think. He's turned into an alcoholic. He dies a rather tragic, mediocre, alcoholic theologian in the 1560s. That was not meant to be funny, actually. That's rather sad, I think. The saddest case of alcoholism I've come across was one of the electors of Heidelberg, one of the electors Palatine in Heidelberg. As you know, in the 16th century, water is bad because it contains illnesses that kill you. So you drink beer, or if you are posh, wealthy, you drink wine. Well, it was the habit to give the elector Palatine, wine from as soon as he was able to drink. So babies were given wine. If you were a baby elector Palatine, you were given wine to drink. And one of the elector Palatines was an alcoholic, I think, by the time he was four or five. It's quite stunning. The alternative is dying, of course, of cholera or typhoid or something like that, something you'd have picked up from the water. Martin Luther Jr., a very, very sad and tragic figure. But it was a happy marriage. And I think it was critical for Luther because he struggled with depression and he was under pressure a lot. And it's something that's come home to me very powerfully recently I'll just throw this out as a piece of practical advice. If you're thinking of going to the ministry and you're married and your wife is not as committed to you going into the ministry as you are, don't go into the ministry. You will torch your marriage. You will seriously destroy your marriage if you do that. So if you're not married, make sure you marry somebody who's as committed to your vision and ministry as you are. If you are married and your wife is not committed to your vision and ministry, don't go into the ministry. You will destroy your marriage. Luther's marriage is a first-class example of a clerical marriage that works kind of against all the odds because it's sort of arranged. But it's also the classic example of a marriage where his wife was able to save him from most of the time from the excesses of his own personality. And that's crucially important. We have a few minutes to spare. Any questions on what we've looked at today? We covered a lot of ground today, so if you've got questions, fire away. Yeah. Yeah.
What was the, I guess, political or theological background
to the Catholic army? Right. Well, you need to know a little bit about armies in those days. I'm moving. I shouldn't move. I should stand rigidly in one spot. You need to know a little bit about armies, and that there are no standing armies. What happens is when people go to war, the local feudal lord calls on his peasant vassals they throw down their mattocks and their plows, and they pick up swords and spears, and they go off to war to fight. So what would have happened is the emperor would have sent out the call to the electors and the princes of the empire. We have a mutual interest in crushing the peasants' rebellion. Join me at Frankenhausen and let's do it. So the in some ways, you know, armies are a great example. It's a good example of where politics at points cuts straight across theological divisions. If you've got to crush a common enemy, then you can do that as the empire. They do it again in Munster in 1536, where a combined Protestant-Catholic army besieges the city and then puts to death the Anabaptists who've taken it over. The Anabaptists are actually engaging in mass murder and child abuse, so it's not so bad there that they're put to death, if you like. It's less brutal than it sounds. No, actually, it's just as brutal as it sounds, but it's more justified. That's what I meant to say. But armies would be rallied for causes. It's really with Oliver Cromwell. This is one of the geniuses of Oliver Cromwell and Thomas Fairfax in the 1640s. They develop a professional army and therefore win the war. And warfare is never the same again. After the English Civil War, everybody needs a professional army because that's how it's going to be done from now on. Any more questions? Next Tuesday, then, we will do Luther and Zwingli on the sacrament. And Wednesday, you'll have Flavien coming in to talk about Calvin on the sacraments.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.